You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we'll never reach peak farce, but that won't stop us from pointing out how much everyone is trying to. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if the last 2 weeks have been as absolutely insane for you as they have been for me, then you have found yourself in the right place. Here is where we point out how farcical, how absurd everything is. And though sometimes some stories may make us cry, that's called a tease in the business, we still find a way to laugh about it in the end. So why don't you tell your friends to come on in to our new fireside chats here in the midside. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, overcoming possibly pneumonia, Daniel T. Richards.
Hello, audience. I apologize for missing last week, and I apologize for sounding like near death this week. I'm now going on almost 2 weeks of being ill, and no end in sight at the moment, other than, you know, death. So there's that. But yeah, glad to be back. I have my new iPhone. That's exciting. That wasn't the worst thing to happen in the past 2 weeks.
Okay, I mean, you went there, so I was going to go somewhere else. I was going to ask if, you know, living in D.C. is what's killing you slowly. But I have to talk about the new iPhone.
Please
at
do.
Least the new iOS, okay? Maybe it's different because I don't have
different.
The new iPhone.
No,
but
it's not.
Dude, I downloaded the new iOS because I wanted one of those Memojis or whatever the fuck they were, where Apple was like, hey.
Anemojis.
Well, okay, whatever they're
right.
called. Whatever they're called, where they were like, hey, the Wii did this 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Let's do this now. Yeah. And I did that. And then I had to disconnect and reconnect all my Bluetooth devices, right? So I'm driving in the morning, and my phone just keeps disconnecting and reconnecting from my Bluetooth. So I had to make the car forget my iPhone, make the iPhone forget my car. And then later at the gym, I only bring in my AirPods. I don't bring in my AirPod case. And I'm without music for my entire workout because I have to reconnect and disconnect and forget my AirPods.
Mm,
why,
yes.
why do you release a software system if it doesn't work? It already worked. My iPhone already worked. It did everything I needed it to. Everything I needed it to. Why do you release something that then I have to refix again and exert more energy and time into this device, which already does what I want it to? I don't need my notes to be bigger text for no reason. I like the size of the text. Why is it bigger text now? I didn't ask for it. What, they assume their user base is slowly getting older and our eyesight sucks? Well, everyone's been staring at their phones for 10 years now, so we better make the font bigger. I didn't ask you to do that. Stop doing things that I didn't ask you to do. And can you test your software before you run it? Before you push it to everyone? Can you test it maybe? Do a little QA?
That was an unexpected Apple rant from Justin, who's still running Windows 95. Because he doesn't like change.
I like change. Here's the difference. I may be aping this from someone. Actually, in fact, I am aping this from someone. I don't know who. It was a meme on the internet. But the difference is, every year, Steve Jobs used to come out and be like, hey, look at this new thing I'm giving you that's changing your life and giving you new things to do. And every year, Tim Cook is like, hey, I made your icons look different on your phone screen. That's the difference, okay? When Steve Jobs came out with new stuff, I was like, okay, you know, I understand. He is making this novel. He is doing new things. But Tim Cook's just, like, making subtle changes in order just to get people to buy stuff. It's what people complain about when they talk about, like, and, you know, I believe we'll get into this. No? I don't remember if we'll get into this or not. But, oh yeah, we will. We'll get into this when we talk about Breaking Bad, the Jesse Pinkman spinoff. It's the difference people were talking about when you have artistic integrity versus you just keep pumping out a product because you know people will buy it. That's what Apple has become. Prove me wrong. I'm Steven Crowder.
Unfortunately, I can't prove you wrong. My phone works better. The battery is probably the biggest noticeable thing. I go to bed now and still have 70% battery, which is ludicrous and awesome. So thank you for that, Apple. But they also took away things like Force Touch. You know what Force Touch was? Is that on your phone where you can like press the screen hard and do certain things? Super useful.
Hold on. Did they take it away because Disney sued them or because it made people associate Apple too much with the Me Too movement?
Well, that was Midsider Mark tweeted out something like, I miss Force Touch, and I had to DM him that hashtag Me Too because I also miss Force Touch. But
yeah, but I added the Star Wars joke to it.
Yeah, which is weird because usually, you know, role-playing. And iOS 13 is garbage at the moment, but at least it's garbage in dark mode, so you can not strain your eyes when your phone's not working at the gym. There's that.
Yeah, I do like the dark mode. I will say that. I do like the dark mode.
Oh boy, they changed the colors.
But it threatens my sense of whiteness and masculinity, Daniel.
Oh, I think other things threaten our sense of whiteness and masculinity.
You
right?
want to talk about it?
Maybe.
Let's do it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
But before we get to the news, I want to remind you all about patreon.com/themidside. It's a platform where content creators like us can get a couple dollars every time we produce a piece of content like this from you, the listener. So go to patreon.com/themidside and become a Patreon supporter today. We would really appreciate it. It helps us keep the lights on. And the lights are the things that we don't want to keep on, according to Nobel Peace Prize nominee Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old taking the world by storm, who is also apparently destroying Asperger's stigma along the way, according to People magazine. Yes, teen climate activist Greta Thunberg has Asperger's, a diagnosis that an estimated 1 in 250 people will receive. But the way she's broken the mold surrounding the disorder is rare. The Swedish 16-year-old, whose prominence had been on the rise before she delivered a fiery speech at the United Nations Climate Action Summit on Monday, hasn't shied away from flipping the script on her Asperger's, at one point referring to it not as an obstacle, but as her superpower. The pride with which she embraces her diagnosis has not been lost on others with Asperger's, who now view Thunberg as a role model. Case in point, the trending Twitter hashtag Autistics for Greta. At Twitter user HM Cooper Author wrote, "She is my Shiro. Such a fearless, articulate young woman. We might be considered odd, weird, quirky, or whatever adjectives that you prefer to insert, but I'm convinced folks on the autism spectrum have superpowers that you all just don't." In fact, Greta herself said on Twitter, "When haters go after your looks and differences, it means that they have nowhere left to go, and then you know you're winning. I have Asperger's, and that means I'm sometimes a bit different from the norm." Remember that part. "And given the right circumstances, being different is a superpower. Hashtag Aspie power." Justin, was she bitten by a radioactive person with Asperger's, or how did she get this superpower?
Asperger's woman? I really wish I could come up with a jingle on the spot, but Asperger's woman doesn't have as many, or it has way too many way too many syllables, so it doesn't work with the Spider-Man theme song.
Aspigal.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah,
but even that does whatever Aspigal can,
which fits with the syndrome.
Okay, so the reason I took this angle on the story, Daniel, rather than going some, you know, other angle, is, first of all, I feel like the other angles are obvious and they've been done over and over again. Like, I believe it was Midsider Motive Power who tweeted out Don Watkins actually responding to the content of Thunberg's rant to the UN, which, yes. I mean, he did very well. I don't want to take anything away from Don. Don did very well. Like, if you want to listen to how to refute her actual arguments, I think Don does it well, and I don't want to step on that because I don't want to redo it, because why redo what somebody else has already done? But also, it doesn't interest me because it's like beating the New York Jets, okay? It's the third string quarterback. They're not a football team. Like, she's not an intellectual. She's not somebody who has any connection to reality. And sitting there and taking her seriously, and I don't mean this as an attack on Dawn, but sitting here there and taking that seriously, I think is more dangerous than anything. I think it's more appropriate intellectually, and more important intellectually, to point out how she's disconnected from reality. And how us as a society, as a culture, as a world, treating her as if she is what's dangerous, most dangerous of all. And that's why I picked this angle. Not to say that, you know, oh, fuck people with Asperger's. Like, that's, I want to be very clear about that. I'm not coming out against these type of people. I think it can be harnessed in a way to make her feel like it's a superpower. But the way her abilities, the way her different mind works, is being used is both tragic and disgusting, okay? Because I looked up her family, and this took me 5 minutes, okay? It's now to the point. It used to be that to figure out what was really going on, like, remember all the time, Daniel, I spent on the Wells report for Deflategate?
Basically years of lost productivity.
Yes, yeah. Because I read it all, and I researched it, and I figured out what was going on. It is now to the point that you just have to read Wikipedia to figure out what's going on, okay?
Good.
So I would say, no, yeah, it makes my life a lot better, right? Because now I can, like, watch The Island on Netflix and then also get angry about that. So I have more time to get angry about other things now.
It's really an anger time saver.
Correct.
Internet. You just
correct.
Can pack 100%. More anger in.
100%. So, in between watching the rape culture show Island, I was able to research Greta Thunberg on Wikipedia. I'm the one person who gets that joke I just made about the Island, by the way.
Well, good. Take time to laugh at it. That's really the most important part, is you, the only person to get your joke, takes time to laugh at it on a show that's broadcast to other people.
So I looked up on Wikipedia, right? And because I wanted to know, I said, how the fuck did this 16-year-old girl get in front of the UN, right? Because that's not like that's not like something that happens every day. It's not like, oh man, like, I'm a 16-year-old Swedish girl, I'm in front of the UN. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, how does that happen? How does it happen, Daniel? Her parents are fame whores. Her mom was a famous opera singer, and her dad was her manager. And then, when she had this thing with her daughter, she wrote a book called Scenes from the Heart. And based upon all that, they've used their notoriety to push their daughter. And this is where it gets sick and disgusting. I am positing that it is more insidious than that. They are taking advantage of their daughter's condition. They are exploiting their daughter to get fame, to get money, to get notoriety. They are parasites on their own daughter. And what I mean by that is, go listen to Don's arguments. Go listen to Don's refuting everything. And I'm sure Daniel will go into it a little bit, because I know this is a pet issue for him. But if you listen to all that, you know that she is disconnected from reality in a way that it would only manifest in her emotional reaction, her performance in the UN, because of her condition. And what I mean by that is, knowing what Asperger's is, right? Knowing that people become hyper focused on a specific interest and hyper vigilant about fixing something, about solving something, about this is their cause. She would be a prime target for all of this propaganda and misinformation. Every person we've ever seen who gets duped by this shit and believes it is doing some form of what she's doing. But her parents have allowed her to be duped in this way, allowed her to become part of this, to become fooled by it in order to take advantage of her for their own personal gain. And then on top of that, after they did that, people are taking advantage of her even more because of that performance she put on. This helps all the people who are pro-climate change to have her out there looking like that. Because now we have the South Park joke from the Tweak episode early on in the run where he was trying to argue against South Park, where Tweak's dad put out the ad, "You don't hate children, do you? If you support Harbucks coffee, you hate children." It's the same thing. So there are a bunch of people taking advantage of this girl and hurting her life because of the fact that she has Asperger's. And it's fucking disgusting. It is disgusting, Daniel.
It is. It is no different, in my opinion, from the children at gun rallies, or, and this may be one of the more controversial things I've ever said on this show, the right wing, using people with Down syndrome at pro-life rallies, for instance. People who need our assistance, who have some sort of form of disability, the last thing they need in their life is to be taken advantage of in this particular way, which is particularly insidious because they don't have the full ability to understand what they're doing. That's a horrible abdication of our responsibility as adults, as rational human beings. And in particular, the way that they're going about it, which is teaching her that she's speaking truth to power, teaching her that she's, you know, a hero, thinking outside the box, that she's standing up to all these great powers.
Shiro, Daniel, get it right.
Shiro.
Because even though the word "her" is in the word, we still had to make it more more feminine. Even though there's also already a word, heroine, we still have to rewrite the word to be more feminine.
Inject that right into my veins. And so, like, saying that, like she said this recently, you know, in some difficult circumstances, it can definitely be an advantage to have some kind of neurotypical diagnosis, to be neurodiverse, because that makes you different. That makes you think differently. And especially in such a big crisis like this, when we need to think outside the box, we need to think outside our current system. We need people who think outside the box and who aren't like everybody else. Justin, is it once in a blue moon that you meet someone who wants to do something about climate change? Are they like a unicorn where you can barely find them, you know, hiding in the enchanted forest somewhere? Or is it every goddamn person? What is it with this nonsense that we need to think outside our current system? We need to think outside the box and be not like everybody else. It is literally the mainstream opinion that we should do something about anthropogenic climate change. You are not being brave. You are being conformist. You are not thinking for yourself. You are literally putting your mind into the collective and saying, thank you for thinking for me. And in this situation, someone who has a disability, think about the insidiousness of that, which is, we're not going to help you lead the best possible life you can lead. We're going to help you lead the best possible life for our quote-unquote society, so you can be a tool for change. So you can, I mean, giving this fiery speech at the UN where she says, you've compromised my future, you've given up, you know, my hopes and my dreams, essentially, just turn that and focus it toward your parents or towards the climate change propagandist culture that is driving you toward this. And it is somewhat truthful. It is certainly not to the people who are providing you with a happy, healthy life, a more prosperous life than you ever could have lived 100 years ago or 200 years ago, the fossil fuel industry. It is your parents who are making you a collectivist tool for propaganda. How horrifying.
I love how her future is destroyed, but she's nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize at 16 years old.
Yes, we're stealing her future. And like the memes and stuff of her, I get it. I get that people want to react against her because of what she's saying. I ask, and to take her argument seriously and deconstruct those is fine, but to act against her as a person, I just strongly, strongly ask people not do that, because she is being taken advantage of.
Yeah, so, I don't, Daniel, I don't have, like, when I watch her speech, I don't have like an emotional reaction where I get angry about it. Where what she's saying, like, you've taken my future, blah, blah, blah. And with the surety she is saying it with, it doesn't do anything to me. It's not the same thing like with the Brett Kavanaugh thing. Like, I had an emotional reaction to watching him speak and watching people speak against or for him. With this, I don't have a reaction. I'm not like, oh man, this argument threatens me. Oh my God, this presentation of the argument threatens me. I say, how does a child really believe that her future is destroyed to this point? How, as I said, I had to go research because I said, how did it get to this point? How did she get to this point? How is she standing? How is she sitting here saying these things in front of the UN? And how does she literally believe these things? And when I found out she had Asperger's, that made a lot make sense to me. And then when I found out who her parents were, a lot made sense to me. So the only time I had any emotional reaction was when I found out the background story, not literally what she was saying. What she was saying was obviously so performative, but the fact that she believed what she was saying and wasn't being performative, I was like, what is going on here? I didn't have emotional reaction. And it's really interesting to me. Do you think it speaks to the immaturity of our culture that is brought about by collectivism? That people are having an emotional reaction to her specifically?
Well, yes, and it's sort of reinforcing, right? Which is that the emotional reaction is the kind of reaction we're supposed to have. Anyone who has an intellectual reaction to what she's saying, even if we're not tearing her down, but we're looking at her arguments and deconstructing them, that's attacking a 16-year-old, right? Because you're supposed to just have the emotional reaction. You're not only supposed to have the emotional reaction, you're supposed to have the same emotional reaction as everyone else. So we're not demanding just collectivism in thought and collectivism in action. We're demanding collectivism in psychology, in your emotional response to this, which is if your heart doesn't break for this girl whose future we've stolen, then you're a monster, you're a Nazi, you're a white supremacist, you're a ethnocentrist, and every other word that we can throw at you, if you don't have the right emotions, Justin, man, the conformity that is demanded of us in the current juvenile culture is becoming apparent and ridiculous.
Yeah, and that's what you said is even more terrifying. The idea that now you're simply judged by your emotional reactions, and people decide if you're good or bad based on the emotional reactions you're having in that immediate moment. Sometimes, Daniel, for me, and we'll see this in the next story, I actually don't have an emotional reaction to things until I process them. Now, there are some things that I have emotional reactions to immediately because I've already processed everything and I understand it on a high enough level that I can react to it in the moment. But there are other things where, as an adult, I've learned as I've grown up, the things that I'm a non-expert in, that I don't spend most of my time in, that I need time to process it. And that I think that's part of, for me, that's part of what's made me feel more mature. But now that it's sad, it's disgusting that I'm judged on that immature level.
Yeah. Well, speaking of other people who are judged on immature levels, Tom Brady.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, speaking of performative people.
It's wonderful that we can combine our loves of Tom Brady and taking down the social justice warriors into one story. Because a professor at the University of Rhode Island recently published an analysis of New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady and his celebrity and portrayal in the media. And what does this professor conclude, Justin, but that white rage and white supremacy is what led to the popularity of Tom Brady in the post-Obama America. Yes, so this article says he's an English professor, which I can't confirm because he has a PhD in kinesiology.
He is, I read his bio, a little spoiler for where this is going. I read his bio on the URI website. He has a PhD in kinesiology, but he got a job in the English department at URI.
Which should tell you everything you need to know about modern-day English departments. You, over there, you got a PhD in PE? Come teach English. So he's an English professor who also dabbles in gender and race theory, as evidenced in a chapter a full copy of which was obtained by Campus Report that the professor, Campus Reform, that the professor authored in a recently published book titled The Palgrave Handbook of Masculinity and Sport. The title of the chapter is Making American White Men Great Again, Tom Brady, Donald Trump, and the Allure of White Male Omnipotence in Post-Obama America. The chapter attempts to provide evidence to back up this professor's suggestion that, like President Donald Trump, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady has gained popularity due to the, quote, latest wave of white rage and white supremacy, end quote, that he says developed since the Obama presidency alongside a, quote, disturbing racial reaction among white conservatives in response to the idea that black men should be president. So, Justin, is Tom Brady okay in your book, if you know what I mean?
Are we allowed to say that? Now, isn't that like a hate symbol now that I'm making?
We're allowed to
symbol?
Say it as long as we don't show it on a webcam.
Okay. Because even though I'm making that hand gesture right now, and I can see the shadow on my wall from doing it, it's okay to do that.
Well, it's not okay. You'll be eventually taken out by the social justice police, much like the SS. But for now, enjoy it.
Okay. I can do it now, though, because I only have the Alexa. I don't have the Facebook portal, right? So I'm only tracked with audio. I'm not tracked with video yet.
That's right. It's coming, though.
Oh, man, Daniel, this story. You sent this to me like half an hour before we recorded, actually, and we subbed out the okay hand symbol being listed as an official symbol of hate now by the Jews, right?
Yes, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League.
Wait, which is a Jewish organization, is it not?
Yeah, but I would refer to them as all the Jews.
I didn't say all the Jews. I just said the Jews. There's a difference.
Okay.
I'm being facetious, right? Which that has a... That story has an appeal all its own about the way narrative is used here, right? And, you know, we talked about this with the label alt-right, and we've talked about it with the symbol, how they build something up as something that's disconnected from reality, but then they repeat it so often that people believe it, and they accept it as true. And we're seeing this now with the Patriots. Was it last season, two seasons ago? How many Super Bowls ago was it? That they were trying to say that Bill Belichick is a white supremacist because he loves white wide receivers.
Yeah, that was like the Seahawks one.
The Seahawks one. Okay, I can't. I lose track. But it's again, this is another attempt to push that narrative, right? The idea that greatness in the current definition is born out of racism. So therefore, we must stop this new form of racism because it's systemic and therefore tear it down. This goes back to what you were saying last story, Daniel, where you were saying, how can people like Greta Thunberg, and I'm not saying her in specific, I'm not attacking her, how can people who take that approach believe that they are in the minority and believe that they are ones who are fighting the power? It's because they believe that they are so woke. This is where the term woke comes from, that they're the ones who are understanding the corruption of the system, whereas everybody else isn't. So even though they're in the majority, they think the system is set up in such a way that everyone, and I'm using that term intentionally because I'm about to pivot to something else, everyone is being hurt by it. And they're the ones who are standing up for everyone, even though they're in the majority opinion-wise. They're the only ones. They're in the minority in that they're willing to stand up against the system. It's a self deception they've created because the left built their ethos, built their image on the idea that they're the ones fighting the power and they have to continue that in some way. And this is the way they've continued it.
Yeah. You want to hear the wokeness of this professor, Justin? And this is one of my favorite parts of this story and one that will lead to another topic that's a running theme of this show. So here it is. In addition to Brady's representation as the epitome of, quote, omnipotent white masculinity, unquote, in his various media appearances, advertisements, and movie cameos, this professor focuses on Brady's public image as it relates to what he calls, quote, American myths of meritocracy and individualism. Among other media appearances, he specifically cites Brady's appearance in a 2015 Under Armour commercial, which he claims would not have been out of place in Leni Riefenstahl's infamous Nazi propaganda film Triumph of the Will, because of its military references and red and black colors. Justin, do you remember what the theme of that Under Armour commercial was that would, quote, fit in, or sorry, would not seem out of place in a Nazi propaganda film? Do you remember what the theme was?
Yeah, I remember, but the words are escaping me at the moment.
Oh, I have the words.
I know you
do. The word was, rule yourself.
Right.
A commercial with the theme, rule yourself, and the theme of the entire commercial was, be the master of your own self, would fit in a Nazi propaganda film?
Well, sure. If you drop all context, it would fit in. You can steal that iconography. I mean, the idea of, and this shows how intellectually either dishonest or intellectually duped these people are. You know, they're either dishonest out. Okay, they're either dishonest outwardly. They know what they're doing, or they're dishonest inwardly. I believe this guy is someone who's dishonest inwardly. I believe that, and we're going to get to this in one second, I believe that this is someone who has been duped by the system. But yeah, if you, Daniel, in that commercial where it's like a bunch of Tom Brady's who all look the same and they all look perfect and they all are practicing together and you're seeing that, if you drop the context of that is supposed to be a concretization of the work he puts in every day, right? Because Tom Brady's all about earn it every day. If you drop that context and you just see a beautiful, heroic white man working over and over again in unison with each other that all look the same, then yeah, you can see how they would twist that into Nazism. But they're dropping context. It is intellectually, as I said, it's either dishonest, but it's intellectually immature. It's underdeveloped thinking. It's confirmation bias. It's seeing what you want from the imagery. It's taking what you want from the imagery, which is, as we've seen over and over again, what modern English analysis is. Is it not? When you watch a movie and you can take whatever you want from it.
There you go.
We're gonna make this connection here, because this would not be the mid-side and it would not be a Tom Brady story if I did not drop this reference. It's the fucking asshole online who tweets out, if you don't think Batman versus Superman is the most left-wing comic book movie, you don't understand the movie. It's the fucking Christian lady who sits there online, and anyone who tweets about the movie, she tweets to them telling them about how the movie's an allegory for Jesus and Christianity. You're cherry-picking to see what you want in it. And it's the same thing in the Tom Brady commercial, and it's the same thing in this narrative. And Daniel, I think that you and I are specifically able to understand this guy's perspective, where he's coming from, and talk about it. And in many ways, this story is why this podcast was born. It's where it came from, right? And I say this because, again, I did the Greta Thunberg research. And what I mean by this is, ladies and gentlemen, just take 5 minutes, okay? 5 minutes. That's all you need nowadays. 5 minutes. That's it. Just I Googled this guy. I Googled his name. Kyle, what's his last name? Kuzma? It's not Kuzma. Kyle
I've
Kuzma.
I've been saying Kuz in my head, but okay, I Kuz. Don't know.
Kyle Kuzma's on the Pelicans now, but do not want to associate. I do not want to denigrate Kyle Kuzma's name by associating him with this. So Kyle Kuzi, I googled Kyle Kuzi URI, and I found his biography. In fact, I found his email address. So if you want to write to him in very respectful and a tasteful way,
don't dox him.
Don't dox him. Well, I think I'm doxing him right now, aren't I?
I was going to say, don't dox him.
Okay, but if you want to write him an email in a very nice and respectful way and explain to him how heroic Tom Brady is and how he has made your life better, I would encourage that. I would encourage that. But please do it in a tasteful, intelligent, respectful way. But his biography on the URI website is there. That is how I was able to find out that he has a degree in kinesiology but is in the English department. Also, did you see where his master's is from, Daniel? And this is where you come in.
Is his master's from Ithaca?
No. That's where I come in.
Oh, sorry. Is his master's from Clemson?
Oh, sorry. His PhD. His PhD is University of Illinois.
No, I'm sorry, everyone.
His master's is University of Illinois as well. Oh, and he has a master's from Ithaca College. Okay? In 1994. All right, 1994. The picture on the website looks a lot younger. What is it with these people putting up deceitful pictures of themselves? I mean, we have the answer to that question, right? They're disconnected from reality, so they can't show who they really are. Right? So, this guy went to Ithaca College. Hey, Daniel, where did I go to undergrad again?
I think it was Ithaca College?
Ithaca College, right.
What?
And if you've wondered, and this has come up, if you are a hardcore Midside fan, Midsider Conrad is going to know this story because he's listened to all the episodes, right? And if you've been around the Midside since the beginning or you discovered it later and binged the whole thing like Midsider Conrad did, dude, I don't know how you put up with us for that long to binge us. But hey, thank you. You know this, what I'm about to say. The reason I am intimately familiar with these arguments, and I was able to see this coming, is because I went to Ithaca. And I got out of high school, and I went to Ithaca, and I saw all of this on the Ithaca campus. This was happening at Ithaca before everywhere else. So it's not a surprise that this guy would go to URI. And this is what the article we have from Campus Reform says. He's like, I went to URI and I was wondering why everyone had this love for Tom Brady here.
He was wondering why people in Ithaca have a love for Tom Brady?
No, URI. He went to URI.
Oh, sorry. He went to URI.
So
oh,
he's
even
in
worse.
Rhode Island.
Yeah. Even worse. Is he looking
right,
at
I'm
a
intentionally,
map?
I was intentionally being silent because... What? What? This is the thing about deceitful, right? This is the thing about self-deception. Do you think this guy's been to a Patriots game?
No, of course not.
Well, if you're doing research, Daniel,
watched a football game.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you're doing research, right, on why people love Tom Brady, maybe go to Gillette Stadium. It's not far from Rhode Island. It's not far. I gear. It's like 45 minutes at most from where you are in Rhode Island because Rhode Island's so fucking small. Okay?
It's 10 steps. Would you, Justin, go with Professor Kuz to a Patriots game for the sake of the Midside? Your parents have season tickets.
You know what? My mom said she did. She has one game left. She's looking to offload. I'm going to email this guy. And I am going to offer to bring him to a Patriots. I am 100% serious right now.
I think you should. I think that would be very magnanimous of you. And you can hash out your differences over a soda and a hot dog and a Tom Brady victory.
I think this is a brilliant idea. I am literally going to email this guy and offer to take him to a Patriots game. Because... it's literally, they're insulated a layer from reality here, not looking at exactly what's going on. And they turn it into this race thing when it's not a race thing. I mean, there's two things I want to reply to. One you already brought up, and I'll end with that because that's the most important thing here. But the other thing is using the Kentucky Derby as an example of Brady's whiteness. Okay? That is both right and wrong. It's wrong in pointing out, oh, well, the NFL is 67 or 76, whatever the number was, percent black. The fact that Brady only brings white people to the Kentucky Derby shows how racist he is. Okay, now, Daniel, it's such a tough issue, right? Because
it's such an English department argument.
Right, because look, it's right on a certain level, okay? And the level it's right on is... Hey, Daniel, who are the people who watch horses run around in a circle and bet on it? What race do they tend to be? What skin color do they tend to have?
Are they Sudanese? No, they're not. Why did you laugh at that?
It's white
they
people.
They tend to be whitey. Yeah.
You're going to you think he's going to invite Stephon Gilmore to the Kentucky Derby and Stephon Gilmore is going to be like, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Right?
You know who he could invite, though, and really confuse people is James White.
Well, James White does have a white girlfriend, though, so I think that guy's a race
that's,
trainer.
That's James White privilege right there.
Yeah, James White privilege. James White privilege has got what got James White the Super Bowl MVP. Because his name was White, Tom Brady got confused and kept throwing him the ball in that Super Bowl. He's like, how do I come back? Well, I'll throw it to the white guy. And then after the game, they told Brady, they were like, you know, he's not actually white, right?
He's like, Brady said, I only see one color, and that's chrome.
Tom Brady sees one color, and it's open, okay? Who is the open receiver? Look, Tom Brady is so racist that he brought Antonio Brown into his house. He even has the last name Brown.
No excuse there, Tom. No excuse there, you Aryan avatar.
So could it be that he's racist, or could it be that when there are people who want to go to the Kentucky Derby, it's something that white people like to do? But here's the thing. This is ultimately an attack on it flat out says it. It's an attack on meritocracy. It's an attack on individualism. That's what this is. They want to tear down the idea that you can succeed on your own, because it's been well documented on this show as well. The story of Tom Brady is the story of meritocracy. It's the story of individualism. When the guy was like a seventh string quarterback at the University of Michigan, when his senior year, even though he was the better quarterback, he wasn't the full-time starter. They just brought him in to win games when Brian Griese was losing them. It's the story of he started out the fourth string quarterback in New England and fought his way to the top and kept working. That's what it's the story of. I mean, he even, Daniel, maybe you remember this from the article, because there's just so much I don't remember. What was his argument against the Brady 6 documentary?
Oh, that he, you know, he essentially positions himself as this quote-unquote 97-pound weakling who had to, you know, make his own way and whatever, and it's a false story that anyone makes their own way, is essentially his argument.
Right. So the way to argue against that is just to argue the systemic issues, right? So this is arguing against individualism with collectivism, and it's not presenting any real argument, right? The argument with individualism is based upon what the nature of humanity is. The argument is, you know, we're all individuals. We all have our own minds. We can all only understand reality on our own. Therefore, we must act as individuals. We have to be individuals. Otherwise, you're just being a parasite on somebody else's deduction about reality, judgment about reality. Judgment was the word I was looking for. This argument by this professor simply says, well, this argument or this artistic piece about individualism fails because it's not collectivism. That's his argument. He doesn't give an argument in opposition based on human nature to say how Brady's story is anti-human nature. He simply says this story about individualism is not collectivism, therefore evil and racist.
I will sum up my thoughts about this to focus on the English department thing and say that probably in the past 30 years, no English professor has made an argument. And what I mean by that is they're no longer interested in actually looking at reality, inducing facts from reality, presenting premises and conclusions, and trying to make an argument out of that. They're only interested in applying critical theory to things that they see. It is the difference between reading and reading into. And their entire raison d'etre in the English department now is to hold up Marx and read into everything racism, sexism, every other ism, so they can tear those systems down, so they can build them back up in their own vision, which is them controlling the world because they're the philosopher kings. I say this not because I hate English people. I was an English major. I say it because I lived it. I come from the fire. That is the English departments in modern-day America. So not an argument, an assertion, and the worst kind of assertion, an idiotic one. So, Justin, we spent an inordinate amount of time talking about Tom Brady. And I think
summed up this show.
I think we have to cut the next story unless you really want to talk about incel violence at Joker screenings.
Okay, the only thing I'm going to say about that is it's another narrative they're pushing, and it makes the movie more compelling because it's like, this movie looks super naturalistic, so why is the media, why are critics coming out against this movie so much? And they're creating a false narrative where the Joker is shown kissing a black woman in the trailer romantically, and they're calling him an incel. So this bears watching. It makes me actually want to see the movie, not for the movie itself, but for the cultural conversation about it. And this is just another way to be aware of the way the narrative is being controlled.
Gotcha. Well, I'm still not interested and will not be watching it. But something that we can maybe reverse on that I'm interested in that you're not going to be watching is the Trump-Ukraine whistleblower scandal. Now, we talk about Trump on this show a bit, but we try not to get into pure politics on this show. But this is a story that I think we have to talk about at least a little bit before we get into the hopeful romantic. And so for anyone unfamiliar, I want to give you a rundown of what the hell's going on here. So basically, there was a whistleblower complaint, an anonymous complaint that was submitted to the Inspector General's Office of the Government that says, I have received information, this is the whistleblower, from multiple U.S. government officials that the President of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 election. That specific interference, we now know, is a phone call that Donald Trump had with the president, the newly elected president of the Ukraine, in which President Trump basically said, I have a favor to ask. And that favor was that the Ukrainian president figure out why the prosecution against Joe Biden's son, Hunter, for illegal activities in the Ukraine was dropped a while ago. And why Joe Biden is going around saying that he, Joe Biden, got the prosecution dealt with, taken away, dropped, whatever it is. So the president of the United States asked a foreign president to investigate, essentially, his likely political opponent's son. And now we're asking, as a country, as a body politic, as a Congress, is that an impeachable offense? Did Donald Trump misuse his power in office to try to interfere with the election in the United States? Justin, are you caught up now?
You actually answered one of my questions.
Okay.
My question was, why Ukraine? Now I understand why Ukraine. Okay.
Not Russia.
I was really worried. I was like, when is Poland going to get smeared in all this? I was like,
it's coming.
People already are attacking Poland, right? We've seen this attack on Poland because people assume it's like a white nationalist country. Although it's funny the way people use white nationalist. They're like, Poland's a white nationalist country. It's like, you realize that's nationalist for Poland, right? They're not on our side, but they attack them like they're on our side. They don't understand what they just hear nationalism as a coded word, right? It's like, yeah, that's nationalism for Poland because everyone kicked the shit out of and killed Poland lots of times, so they're fed up, right?
Right.
I now have another question.
Okay,
what was Joe Biden's son doing in Ukraine? Are they Ukrainian? What was he doing? But why was Joe Biden's son in Ukraine?
I don't know a lot about this part of the story, but he was essentially doing some business dealings, I think, in the oil or natural gas sector that may have been illegal, or at least may have resulted in him getting some sort of illegal payments of some sort. And there was a prosecutor, a Ukrainian prosecutor, who basically was declining to look into it, but who may have offered to look into it, if Trump was elected, or it's unclear there, but that prosecutor went away. That prosecutor is gone. And so the question is there going to be a new prosecution or a new investigation, at least, into this? And Trump was trying to persuade the president of the Ukraine to do that investigation.
Okay, so
now,
before even going, hold on.
Okay.
Before going into the whole, like, interference thing, which is the second question, and it's going to lead into you saying what you want to say. Trump, if you're looking to attack Biden, like, just point out that his son works for the gas and oil industry. Like, doesn't that make a leftist a hypocrite? Shouldn't he have raised a better son? That seems like you have all the rhetoric you need right there. So, and the reason I'm pointing this out and I'm being tongue-in-cheek is, my other question was interference, right? This is such a coded word, because what is the definition of interfere in the election, right? And at what point is it the government's responsibility to interfere? If somebody is corrupt and they are being corrupt, shouldn't that be known? Shouldn't that be exposed? And when I look at this, and when you're explaining it to me right now, Daniel, I think Trump's own best qualities are getting in his own way. And what I mean by that is, it's like he forgot he worked for the government and thought he was a businessman. Because when you work for the government, there are proper channels to do this through, right? There are proper channels to say, well, this is fucked up. If this is true, the American public deserves to know about this, because this is somebody who is one of the top two possible Democratic nominees for the next presidential election, the next presidential cycle. So the American public has a right to know. They should know about this. All that is fine to say. But then when he takes it upon himself to make a call and say, hey, can you guys look into this? Which is completely what a businessman would do, right? I'm not going to deal with the bureaucracy. I'm not going to deal with this bullshit. I'm just going to have these people do it. When he does it himself as a government official, that's where he creates a problem for himself. Because when you're operating within a government system, they have these checks in place so things don't look bad. So it doesn't look like what people are trying to say Trump's doing. Is he doing what they're doing? I don't know. I don't know. And I'm sure you're going to say that. But for me, I don't think this is impeachable enough, because I think there's enough of an argument that he is trying to do the right thing.
Interesting. So, okay. So there's so many things here. First, the words you're going to hear over the next several months, probably until the election, are the words quid pro quo. Was Trump saying, if you do this for me, I will do something for you?
Which is, again, what a businessman would do.
If Trump is simply saying, investigate, or would you mind investigating Hunter Biden, or why isn't there an investigation of Hunter Biden? I don't think it's enough. It's super shady. It's super shady, and it's super unethical. But hello, Donald Trump, and if that's your problem, he should have been impeached a while ago, and I'll get to that in a moment. But if it's quid pro quo, if it's you investigate Hunter and I'll sell you military equipment, which there may be here, that is, in technical terms, super impeachable. Because that is bartering the power of your office to hurt your political opponent. If you are doing something, if you are giving the president of Ukraine something you couldn't give him in your personal capacity for the sake of hurting your political opponent, you should be removed from office immediately and never allowed to hold public office again. Okay? So, now the question here is, like, why did the president stop the sale of some sort of missiles or whatever right before the phone call, for instance, even though it's not mentioned at length on the call? Is there an implied quid pro quo here? That's another thing you're going to hear about all the time. But so political things aside, because Democrats are going to say it's super impeachable and Republicans are going to say it's not, I have a pro-impeachment stance for a totally different reason, and that is we don't use the power of impeachment enough. And what I mean by this is, if we genuinely want people in office who are going to be integrous, who are going to actually do things for the country and not for themselves, or maybe that's a false dichotomy, do things in their own long-term self-interest and thus for the country, then we need to have this threat of impeachment. When people keep telling me things like, well, the impeachment power circumvents democracy, or it's too extreme or whatever, it is written into our Constitution. It is the only mechanism, in fact, that we have in our Constitution to deal with a bad president. We can't indict them. We can't arrest them. We can't do anything. We can only impeach them. And when we take that off the table historically and say, no, we've never thrown a president out of office. We're not going to do it. It's not really an option. Then there is no check on the president other than the election. And the election has its own problems with a two-party system and the nonsense, craziness voting that we have set up. So we only have impeachment, and it should be taken much more seriously.
Especially, Daniel, especially, I think, to really help your argument, especially with how the power of the presidency has grown in the post-Obama era.
Yes, exactly. I think it's the growth is partially a response to the fact that there's no consequences. We're not going to do anything to the president, and we'll just let people vote him in or out, or her in or out, and that's it. No, the president needs to be held accountable by the people's representatives, the Congress, the first branch, Article 1 of the Constitution. Those people, remember them? They need to hold the president accountable, and if we just totally take impeachment off the table for every president under any circumstance, then he is an imperial president. And it's impossible at that point. So I think we should use the power of impeachment more, at least the power of the impeachment investigation and impeaching the president. Just because we impeach the president, Justin, doesn't mean that the president is thrown out of office. If the House of Representatives says the president is hereby impeached, that means that he has done something that they think is egregious that deserves a trial. We should be doing that more often because presidents do impeachable things all the GD time. And we should tell them that. And then they should go to trial in the Senate. And a good percentage of them should probably have been kicked out of office by now. But at least we need to tell them that we disapprove of their behavior, that what they did was reprehensible. That is the very least we should be doing with this. So, yes, Trump should be impeached. Whether or not he should be removed from office is a different question. And I don't have enough evidence to give an answer to that yet.
Well,
at the very least be impeached.
That whole argument, should he be kicked out of office, that's people confusing what impeachment is, right? Because people seem to forget that Bill Clinton was impeached.
Correct. But he was not thrown out of office. He was not found guilty of his crimes.
Right.
So that could happen again here. Trump could be impeached by the House of Representatives, and the Senate could say, no, we're not going to throw him out of office, or we're not finding him guilty of these offenses. But we need that, Justin. We need to be able to use that power against this against the office of the President of the United States, not just Trump. I suspect, if I had my druthers, Obama would have been impeached over several things, not the least of which is the Iran cash situation on his way out. But we don't use it. We've taken it off the table. We've declared it undemocratic or whatever the hell that means, which is stupid at its best because we're not a democracy and vindictive at its worst. So
I'm going to sum up your argument for you.
Please do.
Basically, we're still acting like we have George Washington as president when we have Obama or Trump.
Right. Yes.
We're not living in a world where the people who become president anymore are these high, upstanding, moral people. Our culture has been destroyed to the point that we have shitty people as president. And that's what it boils down to.
Yeah. And certainly a cultural fix is the only long-term fix for this. It's just in the meantime, we need to take these powers more seriously, and we need to use them to communicate to the president that what he has done is not acceptable.
Right.
And not do that again.
I agree with your argument in principle. I get what you're saying. I'm 100% with you. The difficulty of this is the way that collectivism distorts this. Right, because you say that, and then they're just going to start trying to impeach anyone who is not on their side, who's not in their in group, and that's what the left is trying to do, right?
Yeah.
So that creates a problem because it's
I get it. Yes,
and it's, you know, this is largely what the alt-right was founded on, right? The idea that they're using our best interests against us, they're using our best integrity against us. That's the alt-right's argument.
Indeed. And not only that, but also it's just that we haven't even gone down this road, right? We're not even in a place where this power can be abused because we don't use it, period. We've taken it off the table.
Yeah, and unfortunately,
and
things have
that's
become
a mistake.
Well, things have become so collectivized that you even mention this at all, and the right is going to be like, "Well, you're letting the left win if we let Trump get impeached." Like any negative thing that's said against Trump now is like, "Oh my God, the left is winning," blah blah blah. And then like anytime you say anything positive about Trump, the left is like, "Oh my God, you're all right," blah blah blah. Like, role-playing in this episode, right? If somebody were, let's pretend a listener had never heard this episode before, and they were only listening to this story, they would say, "I'm alt-right and you're left-wing," based on our arguments we presented here.
Welcome to the mid-site, everybody.
All right, I think that's a good transition. So let's head in, blah, 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 blah. Wow, I did that well. Let's head into talking about more boring political talk in The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events in the air timeline lapse. My made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused.
If you want to get involved with this conversation all week, if you need this refuge during this week, during the week, if you need to get away from the outrage, join our Discord channel. We made reference to the OK hand gesture being made a hate symbol officially by the Anti-Defamation League. That was a story presented to us by a midsider. I'm not even going to try and pronounce his name. I'm sorry. I like you a lot. You're one of my favorites. But I'm not going to try and pronounce the username. That's not going to go well. He put that in there, and we were going to use it, but then the Tom Brady story came along last minute and trumped that story and another one by accident. But, you know, we'll get into the Joker stuff later. So if you want to get in the conversation all week, join our Discord channel. Now, though, we're going to do a review, and actually, because there hasn't been much coming out the last couple of weeks, I went back in time and I watched Jurassic World. It was like I was back in 2015. Reviewing that's not so interesting. So, Daniel, I was hoping you would say a brief few words about Veep. I never watched this show. I'm interested in the fact that you watched all of it because, to me, it screams like a typical left-wing story.
So I watched. I wanted to wait basically till the show was over to watch it. I tried to watch it while it was running, and I don't know, I found some difficulty with the pacing of it and being able to hold over, you know, week to week or whatever it was, the storyline, because of the way it's done. So I wanted to sort of, quote-unquote, binge watch it. And so I watched all 7 episodes, even though I only thought there were 6. And the show is about Vice President Selina Meyer and her political journey.
7 seasons.
So here's the thing. There are 7 seasons. What did I say?
Episodes.
I meant seasons. There are 7 seasons. I only thought there were 6, but there are 7. So it's 2 shows, in my opinion. There's the seasons where she is vice president, and then when she leaves office, and then the seasons where she is no longer vice president and is out of office and trying to get back into office. The show that is about her in office is in many ways a perfect political comedy, a political sitcom, specifically is how I would call it, because the concept is it shows the humor of the situation, the silliness of the office of the vice president, the silliness of politics, the sort of nonsensical things that they worry about, the fact that they jump through a million billion hoops for photo ops that don't work out. For instance, the fact that she's trying to eat ice cream in a local ice cream parlor but ends up getting food poisoning and throws up when she's eating the ice cream, and that's a very bad photo op, for instance. It's lighthearted, it's silly, it's well-written because it's written by the British satirist Armando Iannucci, who created one of the best shows ever called The Thick of It for the BBC, and also the movie In the Loop, both starring Peter Capaldi. And so it's well-written, but it's subtle. But it's really, in many ways, it's light. It's very light-lifting. You don't have to be involved all that much to understand what's going on and be amused. But here's where the show goes from being a nice, light, funny sitcom about politics to being one of the most insightful political pieces of all time, which is the final 2 seasons where she is out of office and trying to get back into office. The final two seasons focus on the theme of what it actually takes to gain power. And that is a fascinating look, because the show goes from being this very lighthearted sitcom to an incredibly dark, I would say almost depressing comedy. Dark, dark comedy. By the end of it, Selina Meyer is having to basically exploit the people she was closest to in her life, even though she never got close to many people, but the people who cared for her more than anything, the people who sacrificed their whole lives and careers for her. And it is culminated in, and this is definitely a spoiler for anyone out there, it culminates in her having to throw her bag man, Gary Walsh, who is played by the same guy who played Buster Bluth, but I cannot remember his name to save my life.
I was just going to guess, because he's the only other person I recognize in the show, and I was going to call him Buster too, so.
Anyway, he is like fiercely devoted to Selena in an almost obsessed way, but in a very childlike, sort of like you're my mother kind of way.
And it, so the show, she's Lucille 3?
That's a good way of putting it. The show culminates in a scene where she essentially has to throw him under the bus with the FBI because her nonprofit, which was illegally taking funds, she's about to be indicted. So she has to have a fall guy, and there's only one person left, essentially, and it's her bag man. And that's the only way she gets to become president of the United States. And the moment that it happens is insanely dark and almost like to the point of wanting to cry. Because this guy represents innocence in the show. The sort of person who's in politics without knowing how evil and corrupt it is. And the show then becomes this deeply touching but scary look at power. And that's why I think it's ultimately a great show. In terms of the left-wing, right-wing politics, it gets somewhat into it. But Selena as a character is so ruthlessly pragmatic that although she's portrayed as being left-wing in the show, she often sells out her politics for money or power or any position whatsoever, including winning, essentially a Nobel Prize for freeing Tibet. She sells Tibet basically back to the Chinese for their help in interfering in the election. So the show is mostly a damnation of power, sort of no matter what side it's on, which is ultimately why I think it's great. It is not at all a light look at government and politics. So if you like shows that both make fun of government and then also show how evil it can be, you'll like it. If you don't like swearing, you will hate this show. So after the last two seasons, get into some of the most obscene fits of swearing I've ever heard in any television show. And I've watched The Sopranos and the thick of it. So that's my review.
Well, and it's hard to think of a show as being very left-wing if it's actually satirizing and commenting on how corrupt politics are, how corrupt government is.
Yeah, it doesn't leave room for thinking like, oh, because she's right-wing, she's corrupt, or she's left-wing. It's basically, if you're in politics, you're corrupt and you're awful. You're an awful person. Like, no one is left unscathed in the show.
So it's probably more left-leaning, but it's probably more libertarian is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. Just basically, yeah, anyone who's skeptical of power, I think, will really like the show. Political power.
All right, that was an excellent review. Let's move on to not things that have already finished airing, but things that will come out in Trailer Takedown. As always, the trailers are posted at the latest on Saturday morning on themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. You can watch them before the episode. You can watch them during the episode. You can maybe, listen to a trailer review and then pause it and watch it. Or you could watch it and then listen to the trailer review. That's up to you.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Wounds is a Hulu original movie starring Armie Hammer. In it, he plays a bartender who takes home a phone that was left at the bar and starts going through it and finds disturbing things. And then the movie, in the trailer at least, becomes this like
psychological thriller sort of horror movie where things are sort of abstractly, he's seeing things that are abstractly not there, or maybe they are there. The trailer makes it seem like his mind starts going crazy, but I'm not sure it's the phone exactly that causes it. And that's also where the disconnect in this trailer comes in, because Daniel, I really like the premise of this. And what I mean by it is I think it's elegantly simple that he's a bartender who finds a phone and there's a mystery on the phone. And that is the inciting action of the story. I think that is an elegantly simple premise that hasn't been done yet in the year 2019. What do you think of that premise?
If you just said, here's my premise, I would say to you, it's a hit.
But then where it goes is very confusing. So this is one where I am on the fence about, because I like Armie Hammer. I think he's one of the most underserved actors in our culture. So I like him. I like the premise. But I have decided, and I said this last week when you were here, that I'm going to be more honest with these, where I think I was hugging a lot when it was something I would like to see. But with the little time I have, it's hard for me to see things, so I have to factor that in. And for this one, because of that, tackle.
Yeah, I liked this movie when it was called The Ring and not The Ringtone. Dad humor. So, I don't know. I actually had to stop watching the trailer because it got a little too gruesome for me. Not really my genre. If it was just a thriller, if there was no horror element to this, if it was like a murder mystery or some sort of assassination attempt or something like that, I would probably be all in on this movie. But because it goes a weird horror route, I'm out. Tackle.
Second trailer.
Uncut Gems stars Adam Sandler as a bookie, some type of gambler, a super Jewish guy. And I say that not because of my jokes I made earlier, but because those jokes I made earlier is what Adam Sandler is going for in this role. He is playing that stereotype, and I don't know if anyone else could get away with it in the year 2019, to be honest. But this looks like Adam Sandler playing an actual role. This isn't one of his Netflix movies. It looks like he's really trying hard. Looks like he's good. This looks like Adam Sandler's like, you know what? I'm bored. I'm going to try and win an Oscar. That's what this looks like. And in it, he plays a bookie, a gambler, who is heavily involved in the gambling community. There doesn't seem to be anything else that this trailer shows about the story. There are two other things I want to say about it, though. Kevin Garnett randomly being in this movie. What the fuck? As a Celtics fan, I was like, what? It also seemed like somebody was selling their Celtics championship ring in this movie. So I was like, what? And then the other thing, and this is what I really liked about this. This is the one thing that really stood out to me about this trailer. When he makes a bet and somebody tells him that the bet is insane, and all he does is reply, I disagree, and he walks away, it's like my brain is used to Adam, and then you just say Carolla. The way Adam Sandler delivers that line is so well delivered, and it's so well written, and it makes the character feel admirable amongst all of this like corruption that's going on. So that's the positive I'll say about this. And the negative is this looks like more just sort of typical naturalism, just in the form of like gambling. So tackle. Daniel,
did you know that Adam Carolla for a time tried to get people to replace Marco Polo with Adam Carolla? Adam. And then you would say.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that because it's stupid.
Oh, okay. Anyway. So that reminded me of that when you had the association.
Yeah, but at least my association is with the first name Adam, you know?
Okay. Anyway. The Adam Sandler role in this looks excellent, like, which is weird because I don't think of him as a good actor, but he looks like a competent, genuinely good actor in this role, which is strange. But the rest of the movie looks atrocious in terms of plot and directing and all other things. So No. Tackle.
Tackle.
Kevin Garnett, I'm sorry. Anything is possible except me seeing this movie.
Third trailer.
Frozen 2 is the sequel to Frozen. We previously talked about the teaser trailer where they like went out to the ocean and they were like, this is a dark movie and it's dark and Frozen is dark. This trailer went much more into the mythology of the world where there's like a civil war general who's black fighting in a magical force. I really do not understand this trailer at all. All I know about this trailer is this does not look like Frozen at all. It was like, hey, now that we have these characters, let's do something batshit insane. And I was like, I'm here for this, Disney. If you want to do this, I want to see what the fuck you're going to do. Because none of this makes any sense. And it doesn't seem to have any of the annoying ideas that were behind the first one. With the whole, you know, let it go undertones and the whole, like, men are evil undertones of the first Frozen. None of that seems to be in this one. So there is a lot to like about this. And this is the other thing I'm going to say about Frozen, Daniel, that I think you'll appreciate. In this trailer, I only noticed Kristen Bell's Kristen Bell voice once. And I've always noticed that about Frozen. I've always heard that, like, Kristen Bell is the voice of Anna in Frozen. But every time I've seen it or, like, I went on the rides and stuff, I never heard her voice. So I think is she actually trying to, like, do a different voice as the character in this movie?
Lost art.
And, I mean, even Josh Gad is trying to do a different voice as Olaf. So you know what? With how popular this franchise is and how batshit insane this trailer looks, I'm hugging.
Hug.
Wow. So I'm not that enthusiastic about it. I would say that just from the trailer, it looks epically better than the first Frozen, which was such a strange story, that especially that it caught on so much. But I can't honestly say that I will go to a theater and watch this. I do plan to be a subscriber to Disney Plus, so what I will say is when this comes on Disney Plus in 18 years from now or so, then I will watch it then. So that's kind of a Netflix and hug, but it's really a Disney Plus and hug for branding reasons.
Hug!
Speaking of Netflix,
final trailer.
El Camino, a Breaking Bad story, is the sequel. Is the sequel story to Breaking Bad you never asked for. Did you think Breaking Bad ended perfectly? Did you think it was the perfect demonstration, the perfect artistic demonstration of a man's descent into evil and what it does when someone becomes evil? Wow, then do we have a sequel for you? Wait, what? So, because people decided to have sympathy for Jesse Pinkman, and because we're living in the year 2019, where corporate marketing and being able to make a buck off of people is more important than artistic integrity, Vince Gilligan has apparently decided to go in with Netflix to make the story of what happens to Jesse Pinkman after Walter White dies. Now there's a few things here. I've already, you know, hinted at the idea of, you know, I don't know why this guy who's supposedly this artistic genius and this amazingly artistic, is supposed to have all this artistic integrity, was okay with making this movie. It seems like he would just be like, ah, the story's done. Then again, I probably should have seen this coming with the fact that he was like, you know what? I'll make a prequel about Saul. Oh, yeah, that seems like a good idea. What the fuck? Like, dude. And that's just what I want to see is six seasons of Saul selling his soul, right?
Thank you, Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's just because of how good of an actor he is, right?
Right.
Where's the Bill Burr spinoff? If there's one Breaking Bad spinoff I want, it's where's Bill Burr? What happens to Bill Burr?
It's called Bill Burr's stand-up specials.
No, but we leave Bill Burr and Huel just laying on the money, and what happens to them? I want a spinoff movie of Bill Burr just spending shitloads of money and being like, this is what rich people do? This is white privilege? This is privilege? I don't want this. I just want to watch the Pats. What's going on? I want that spinoff movie. Can we have that? So
this just shows that as good of an artist Vince Gillian is, he's not above doing what everyone else does and just fucking like, oh yeah, we can capitalize on these dumbass Breaking Bad fans. Because that's what's so dumb about this movie, Daniel. That's what's so dumb about this movie is, first of all, did you know that people after the teaser were trying to argue that Walter White's still alive? Even in this trailer, they're trying to argue that Walter White's still alive.
Maybe he... the trailer gives no evidence that he's alive whatsoever. But they think wasn't he filming?
Was he?
So I thought he was filming. Maybe they're doing flashback scenes.
I fucking hope they're doing flashback scenes, okay? They're trying to argue the scene where it's like, you ready? Is Walter White. So that's who Jesse's talking to.
Okay. I mean, maybe. Also, that'd be stupid. But maybe. But it would be stupid.
I mean, for the sake of the show... And again, having these sequels doesn't destroy the show. Having the remake doesn't destroy the original show. So Breaking Bad will always exist with Walter White dying. But having him come back and going back to the Jesse-Walt dynamic does nothing. It all does is stagnate the story. And if this is an hour and a half, 2 hour, maybe a 3 hour movie at most, which I highly doubt it would be 3 hours, you're not advancing the story. This has to be a story about the repercussions of what happened on Jesse Pinkman. And that's the perverse thing, right? Everyone sees him as this victim, as if he's a good guy. Is he more moral than Heisenberg was? Well, yes, but Heisenberg was ultimate evil, and that was the point. Showing that how everyone becomes a victim of that ultimate evil. Being a victim doesn't make Jesse Pinkman a good guy. I hate to break it to you, he still was a meth cooker who dealt drugs and committed violent actions. Jesse Pinkman's still a bad guy. And I hope to God the movie shows that. I do. And I hope they only use Walter White in flashbacks. Because the certain segment of the population that sees Jesse Pinkman as a good guy, and even worse, there are people who see Walter White as a good guy, that he was just a victim doing what he could. This whole systemic thing, right? They're saying systemically Walter White was held down and this is what he could do. Breaking Bad is an answer to that. It's supposed to say this is what you don't do. This is what happens when you pervert the idea of American individualism and the American meritocracy. You pervert it with the idea of systemic and saying, oh, the system is against me. So I hope to God Walter White's not alive. I hope to God they continue with Jesse with the bad. And just because I've seen all of Breaking Bad and I have this, I'm going to fall back on the sunk cost fallacy, Daniel. I'm into this. I watched all of it. I'm not going to, waste the opportunity to not see this because I've already seen it all. It's a narrative I already know all about. I'm going to hug it.
Hug.
Not where I thought that was going. I don't know. This could be good because Vince Gillian is good. But I just can't, I'm not interested. The story was so perfect. I don't care. Just go back and rewatch Breaking Bad. It was a perfect show. Why do you need this? And if there's no Walter White in it, then it's not Breaking Bad. It's just bad. And I'm not interested. So tackle.
All right, Daniel, a lot of interesting topics this week. So the show ran very long, longer than usual through two segments. So let's wrap this thing up. What did you learn this trip?
What did I learn this trip? Well, I learned that that the arguments for impeachment are not the same thing as the arguments for leaving office, which I think people conflate. What did you learn?
I learned that Veep is actually a pretty redeemable show, and my perceptions about it were perhaps wrong because I'm so hypersensitive to the prevailing culture and the prevailing way in which visual art is made in our mass marketed, mass produced visual art is made in our society.
Fair enough. Well, we hope you learned something this week, and if you did, I guess you could tell us about it on the social medias at The Midside everywhere that social media can be found. You can also go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the previous episodes like Midside or Conrad. What a trooper. Picking up things there like Nolan Notes and Snyder Series and all the things like that. You can also go to themidside.com/store to get your Midside merch, your False Dichotomy Bro shirt, your Classic Tee, or your Hail Snydra apparel, all available for you at themidside.com. Subscribe to us wherever you can find podcasts, but particularly on Apple Podcasts or Google Play Podcasts or whatever it's called now, so you can get this episode delivered to you the moment Justin presses publish on Midside Monday. Leave us 5-star reviews there. We move up the ranks when you do that. Surpass people like Welcome to Night Vale. Is that even still a thing? Have we outlasted Welcome to Night Vale? I don't even know. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Libertarians represent. And then Patreon.com/TheMidSide, where you can go and give us a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. Helps us keep the lights on. Sometimes we even have Patreon-exclusive content. Wow. So go there, give us a couple bucks. But if you can't do that, the most important thing you can do this week, every week, weeks into the future, further in time, the year 2050, is tell a friend. Telling a friend about the show is the only way the show really grows, because we don't pay for advertising. So please do tell your friends, and until next time, we love you.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin blah, blah, blah. Wow. I can never say my name. I'm Justin Emelzeski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a Justin Emelzeski. You were going to ask in the third segment if there were any scary NFC teams. There's only one out of the entire NFC that I'm afraid of at all, and that is the goddamn Giants. No, I'm
really?
Kidding. It's the Cowboys.
Yeah, I'm saying
the Giants for effect, but...
Oh. Yeah, I thought the Cowboys looked really good in week one, but then I forget who they played later that didn't look great against,
they,
so...
They struggled a tiny bit against Miami.
Oh, that's right.
But they're still... pretty good, and they're pretty solid all around.
Yeah.
They're not great all around, but they're pretty solid all around, and they have an offensive line to die for, so.
Yeah. They're like the one team in the league with a good offensive line this year.
Yeah, so that's it. Belichick to premises right there.